And we're with Marshall Masters and his very provocative statements and predictions. Back with more in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Marshall, let's talk about the two sons video, of course, December 21st, 2012. Mm-hmm. The two sons video. You revised it somewhat, didn't you?
Well, the video that I did, actually, this video is just the backstory to the book. I didn't revise anything.
All right.
But what I wanted to do was something that would help introduce this to folks and to give them the backstory, the provenance, if you will. And in there, I have two incredibly talented crop researchers and documentary producers, and Patty Greer and Suzanne Taylor. And they both did award-winning videos, documentary videos in 2008. Both of them featured this formation. I also had a chance to interview other people that had walked it. And this was really vital into the research because I didn't get a chance to. I mean, gosh, you know, one of my dreams, like, please, you know, before the guacamole hits the fan, just one day in England, I could go and walk a formation and then... And then that night, go have a pint within the pub with the crappies and just talk. Wouldn't that be delicious?
It would be.
Oh, yeah.
All right, so let's talk about this binary star system. Where is it, in your opinion?
Well, where is the object?
Yeah.
What right now the formation tells us is that this is in a comet-like polar orbit, highly inclined to the ecliptic. And so that means it's in a real fast mover. And so there's something that's called the COSI mechanism that was really instrumental, a turning point in our research that we came across years ago. And it was Andy Lloyd actually was struggling with it, and then we took a look at it, and it went click. Because everyone's going, well, if it's 3,600 years for Nibiru to return, it should be here if we have it on a train schedule. So why isn't, you know, this, that, why are we not seeing exact dating? And however, and the dating schemes were just driving me crazy. But simply in a nutshell, 1962, a Japanese astronomer by the Yoshide Kozai postulated that a formula that explains how objects interact with each other and alter each other's orbit. And so... if you're in an equatorial orbit, all right, and as the planets are, and there we are, we're going around the ecliptic, and it's nice and steady in our near circular orbit, that's one thing. That's very stable.
Sure.
But if you have an object that's going, cutting across the grain, if you will, if, you know, it's inclined, steeply inclined to that, or even in a polar. So instead of, you know, you could think of it this way. Instead of going, you know, from left to right, it's a top to bottom. And objects that are in those kind of orbits, according to the COSI mechanism, are inherently unstable.
Is this the same orbit that Zechariah Sitchin has presented in his books, the Earth Chronicles? 3,600-year elliptical orbit?
Yes, except what I would say, and I don't think that Zechariah Sitchin... I am a deep admirer of Sitchin. The only thing that I thought Sitchin, he stretched himself a little too thin, was when he went into astronomy. Because there were some things he missed. The thing about the COSI mechanism, what it tells us, is that when an object is orbiting this binary system, it's this little mini constellation is orbiting around our sun, and it's in this steeply inclined orbit, that the natural tendency for these objects is to do one of two things. Either it's going to get thrown out of the system and become a rogue out in deep space,
mm-hmm.
or it's going to death spiral into the sun. Now, keep in mind, Nostradamus says in about 1,700 years, that's it, game over. And that would actually be consistent with what the COSI mechanism says, that this object is highly unstable, and it's going to eventually hit a point where it's just going to death spiral into the sun, which if it does that, then Earth is gone. It's toast, and it's game over on an event that large.
Well, you know, the conference I was at this weekend, everybody on the stage, on this panel I hosted, was upbeat about 2012. No doom and gloom at all, which is totally contrary to what you see.
Yeah, to me, that's Bambi buys the world a Coke. you know, I mean, it's optimistic. I mean, well, hey, remember the first Superman movie? Jor-El is telling everybody, all these folks, that, hey, our son is going to hose us, and everyone going, nah, it ain't going to happen.
And it happened.
And so we get Superman in the deal. And I see the same thing here. The thing about 2012 that really amazes me is I thought in 2012 people would start opening their minds more to what's happening and seeing what's happening. Then I'm finding the reverse. That people are pulling the covers over their head. And so it's this notion that, you know, on December 21, 2012, the universe is going to flip a switch and we're all going to be singing Kumbaya. No. I mean, is it an evolutionary event? Is it one where we can become more than we are now? Absolutely. Hopi prophecy rock, I think, nails it.
What about the Book of Revelation? That may nail it at the same time.
Yes. You find the parallels in the Book of Revelation. I'm working on a project with Richard Shaw, the Torah Code Project, and I find that immensely interesting. What the Torah Code Project is saying, the tables that they're coming up with, and they've brought me in originally on this, they only had one reference to Planet X, or Nibiru, as they're searching for it, or Nabiru, which would be the Aramaic pronunciation. And they found one reference in 2012. In 2013, it pops up like a case of the ticks. And so that's where we're seeing it in this, because the year that we're in right now, the Hebrew calendar year, is actually mid-2012 to mid-2013. And that is going to be very consistent with everything that we're seeing. But, you know, and you've been following this stuff for years.
Yeah, sure.
How much prophecy have you found for beyond 2014?
Not a lot.
Yeah.
Not a lot.
Not a lot. I mean, it's like you really got to look.
As a matter of fact, a couple psychics say they can't see beyond these dates.
That's right.
That's weird. Right.
It's weird. But, you know, Ed Dames, I've been following his works for years. I mean, I remember his Kill Shot video, and I've always loved it. I've played it again and again. And I remember he was on a few months ago, and, you know, it was like, you're asking him, what about this? We're toast. What about that?
We're toast. That's why they call him Dr. Doom.
Yeah, I know. And he was finally, you know, you're like, throw me a bone. Is there any good news? Yeah, aliens won't let us nuke the planet. And then you were asking him where it was coming from, and he just was saying, because I see so much evil in the world.
Yeah.
I melted when I heard that.
I see that too, don't you?
Oh, do I see it? I feel it. I know exactly where he's at, George. I just, you know, and I could hear it in your voice. I could feel it. Just if you'd had a chance to reach across the mic and give him a hug and say, man, it's okay. You'd have done it. And because you could sense it was there in his voice, and he was so sad, and he was seeing it, and I see it too. But, you know, I'd like to share one thing that I also see that gives me hope, that fills my life with joy, and keeps me slogging on. Because, yeah, I've talked to all the folks that are building bunkers for $1 million, and, you know, and the ones that are, you know, well, I don't know. Maybe.
Sounds like a Twilight Zone movie.
Yeah, it is. But here's the kicker. I've been talking to grandmothers and grandfathers across the country. Here's an amazing thing. Once they've become widows or widowers, and they're free to bust a move however they want, they sell their homes in the city, they move out into rural areas, usually they buy farms where, you know, the farmer has sold off his land to large interest.
And sure.
Like 10 or 20-acre parcel. They're buying these. They're moving in, and then what they're doing is they're going to, like, Salvation Army, whatever, the thrift shops. They're buying blankets, sleeping bags, clothes, shoes, and they're buying this stuff for men, women, and children of all ages, all sizes, whatever. They're principally, they just look for stuff that's all natural cotton, all natural wool. And I ask them, you know, are you doing this for your family? And all of them say the same thing. Essentially, my family thinks I'm as crazy as a peach orchard boar. They're doing it because they feel a sense of mission, that they know that the time is going to come when the universe, God, whatever you want to say, is going to bring people to them to help them, to give them comfort and shelter. And they are setting aside provisions for small communities of people to survive. And these are people in their 70s and in their 80s who could just say, you know, I've had my life. It's been good. It's on your watch. And they're not doing it. They have this incredible sense of mission and love. They inspire me. I've got one man turned 94 out in Florida. And he first started following Planet X when he read about it in a book after the Great Depression back in 1933 as a young lad.
Did it scare him?
Yeah. And he followed it through the years, has continuously been studying it. But, you know, we published, I got a young man, Justin Bradwick, and he did a fabulous article on media cover-up about the Planet X conversation, because one of the comments we always get from people is, well, where did this come from? This is a modern-day fiction that came out of nowhere. Justin has actually gone into mainstream newspaper media reports all the way back starting in 1950, and we have documented a historical trail. You can see the conversation and when the conversation changes. Now, the conversation starts off with Planet X, then you see Nemesis Theory coming in, all right, which is that we're in a binary system. This is a whole lot of excitement. I'm old enough to remember it when I was in school, the whole thing. I mean, even Carl Sagan wrote a book about it. And there was all of this discussion. But two events really changed the dialogue. 1983 IRAS. And the other one was Robert Harrington's mysterious death, I think, in the early 90s. And that one was the real death blow to the whole conversation. When Harrington died under very, very suspicious circumstances.
They all die under certain bizarre circumstances, don't they?
Yeah, they do, don't they? And it's always plausible deniability, isn't it?
Yeah, it sure has. Well, let's look at these predictions of Casey, Nostradamus, the Bible, Hopis. Don't they all seem to focus in on the same thing?
Yes, they do.
Some major event.
It's a major event. And, you know, what I see is that the prediction in the Avebury Formation, which is absolutely...
And paint a picture for us, Marshall. Those people who haven't seen it yet on our Twitter feed or on your website, paint the picture on what it looks like.
Okay. Let's say you're looking at it, and what you see is the complete formation. You would see two huge circles, like spectacles, you know, eyeglasses. And the one to the left has got the celestial alignments of our planet. You can see all of the planets orbiting the sun.
And pretty accurate, right?
It's absolutely, on the major planets, it's dead on. Pluto, interestingly enough, is shown advanced in its orbit. It's further ahead than where it should be, according to what we're saying, which would then imply that Pluto's orbit is being perturbed by something passing beneath it or around it. But something is causing its orbit to be perturbed. And if the placement of Pluto is absolutely accurate in this formation, it tells us that Pluto is either going to spin out into space, become a rogue object, or it's going to start a slow death spiral into the sun. And that's what this formation is showing us. But the real focus is on all the major planets. The alignment is absolutely spot on for December 21, 2012. Now, that's off to the left. And to the left, there's a map legend. And this was the key to understanding, unlocking the whole thing. A fellow by the name of a Canadian engineer in our team, Richard St. Laurent, discovered the legend. And what the legend simply says is that this is an incoming object in an elliptical orbit steeply inclined to the ecliptic. And so, like legend, it's telling you what you're seeing with everything else, and it connects all the dots. And then you actually, to the right side, is this huge open circle, and which is really odd. I mean, this as an asymmetric formation. Most crop circles are symmetrical. They're like snowflakes. They follow these patterns. Asymmetrical is just, it's all, you know, you don't have that snowflake kind of pattern. This is the most asymmetrical formation I can recall, and I've been following it for some years. Now, in the one that's off to the right, there's a lot of theory about it, but for us, it's real simple. It's, and this was the one that was nailed by Dutch physicist Jaco van der Voort, is that that is the plane of the ecliptic, all right? And with us being in the center, in other words, that big circle to the right is our X marks the spot. It's us. It's right here. If you are standing in this circle, and what the actual formation decodes to say is that, I say that in the video, we'll see it on December 21, 2012.
And how often is it coming around? Again, Sitchin would say every 3,600 years.
It would say, my thinking is that if the Kozai mechanism is consistent, and I think it applies here, that the next time this object flies by, it's going to come much sooner, and it could very well be captured in and pulled into the sun, in which event there's a catastrophic eruption, solar eruption, that would just hose our planet. And that then you have that perfect knowing where literally the surface of the planet is ripped off, and that's the end of life on Earth, which just goes to the point. It's like, as a species, we need to get the heck out of
here. Yeah, we do. By the way, that was a great movie.
It was.
Nicolas Cage movie.
It was. And as a matter of fact, in my video, I mean, everyone's familiar with that scene at the end, which is really dramatic. But there's actually, in the movie, he plays an MIT physicist, astrophysicist, and he's studying the suns, and he's got a simulation video.
That's right.
And so, I found it. Love YouTube, where you find the darndest things. And found it on YouTube, and I put it in my video because that, for me, really talks about what happens with the solar event. Now, in the Avebury Formation, what's really important here for the listeners, again, you got the visual image. We've got big old spectacles. Got the one to the right that's X marks the spot. It's just a big empty circle that says if you're standing in this circle, here's what you're going to see. To the left, the big circle has all of the planets and the sun. And you're seeing the orbits. Now, what happened was when these two formations, they appeared about 5 days apart. And in the first one, what you see for December 21, 2012, is that the sun and the planets are all normal. But
let's hold on for a second, Marshall. We'll come right back to it on Coast to Coast AM. And next hour, we'll take your phone calls with Marshall Masters as we talk about what's out there. What do you think? We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Marshall, the break got us when you were talking about the possibilities of this object, when it comes back and how often, but I'll let you finish that up before we go on.
Okay. The upshot is that, particularly with the solar event, because we talked about that in the movie Knowing, and I said, well, I didn't think it would be that extreme, because what the formation, in the movie Knowing, that little graphic that they used shows that this eruption actually comes all the way out to Earth's orbit. And what the formation is actually showing is that the eruption goes as far as the orbit of Venus, which means Mercury is just a bone to be chewed, and Venus is going to get hit really hard. But it's going to be really nasty for us here. And that means folks are going to have to go to ground and to get underground and to know when to have shelters. One of the things I can say for people, because we are coming into a period where we're already getting it from NASA and from National Academy of Sciences and other prestigious bodies that we're expecting a real nasty solar maximum here in late 2012 going into 2013. And here's a little trick people can start doing tomorrow morning to get a little bit of advantage. For me, it's if you have enough little advantages, it can add up to a big advantage.
Sure.
And take your cell phone. Wherever you go, where you shop, you work, you go to school, walk around the outside of the buildings, see how many bars of reception you have. Then when you're inside the buildings, go around to areas, and what you're looking for is to find an area of that building where you have no bars of reception, or as few as possible. Let's say you're in a mall, and you find under an escalator, for some reason, there's no cell signal underneath that escalator. Remember those spots, because the reason why you're not getting bars on the cell phone is that the materials are blocking the radiation. And in a solar storm, this stuff's just going to come straight down from the top. All right?
In the X flares we talk about aren't going to scorch the planet. They just shut down the power grids and everything else. This is different, right?
What the formation is definitely telling us is that this is it. This is life as we know it stops, period. We don't stop. We're going to survive. It's going to be a dieback event, and the pole shift's going to be even worse. But this is something, and this is the reason why we've got a whole flotilla of solar observatories out there. I mean, there's a flotilla of solar observatories. They're looking at the sun every 6 ways to Sunday because, like I said, they want to know the sniffle before the sneeze, because when the sneeze happens, we'll probably lose half of those satellites just on one storm alone. They'll just get roasted. And when a solar eruption happens, a storm's going to happen, two things. First, you're going to have the radiation, x-rays, and that's going to get here at the speed of light, 8 minutes, all right? No warning. It'll roast satellites. And, at that point, it's like the Earth stood still. That movie, classic.
Right. The rest will give us a little warning, not much.
That's it. Yeah, it's just a little. When you all of a sudden, cars stop moving, everything starts dying, all the electronics start dying, then we're getting hit.
So your catastrophe.
You have already mapped out all of these little spots. With your cell phone, if you're at school, where your zero bar spots are. You're
right.
In the mall, run like hell to get there. Because that solar storm's going to last for about 30 minutes, and if you're standing out to catch the full brunt of it, you're the poodle in the microwave. And you don't want to be that. You want to get as much of advantage as you can. So get out there wherever you shop, go to school, work, play. It's your life. And just wherever your life is, be mindful of these things. When you're driving down the road, play a game with your kids. Give them a quarter for every time they spot a culvert or something under the road. Because if you're on the road and that happens, that culvert's going to give you more protection than being out in the open in your car.
But this is all short-term, Marshall.
This is all short-term, but at least it's something that people can start doing tomorrow morning. And to get them in the habit of doing this, it's so hard for folks to get off the dime. What's doubly hard right now is we just have this, we have an economy that it's just people are getting slammed left and right, coming out of school as debt slaves.
That's what we're talking about that tomorrow, as a matter of fact, student loans for a couple hours.
Man, I'll tell you, I definitely want to hear that because I feel so sorry for those kids that are coming out. It's a yoke of slavery around their necks. And, you know, for folks right now, they're getting hit from so many different directions, being pressured that, you know, insurance premiums just increasing astronomically, you know. And this on top of everything else, just one more thing to worry about with resources becoming even more scarce. They don't want to go to that. And so for a lot of people, it's in the first thought in their mind is, well, if I really look at this hard, I'm going to have to set aside time, energy, and money, and I'm running pretty short of those three. And so there's a real tendency for a lot of folks to pull the covers over their head and, you know, not to do that. Now, on the other hand, other groups that I see that are very active in planning and preparation, all right, are folks that are involved in some area of risk, whether they're taking risks, managing risks, evaluating risks, mitigating risks, whatever it is, but they're in some sort of risk function. So they're insurance, security firms, whatever. These people are absolutely, very quietly, rocking and rolling. They're making their plans. They buy a lot of my books, all right? And, you know, when I talk
to these preppers?
No, they're not preppers like you see on TV. I mean, George, if I had the network come to me, not once but twice, to say, you know, would you jump in and work on this show? And I said, excuse me, I'm telling people to prepare. And if you're going to go on television and say, here's all my goodies, it's like go get a banker to take the combination to his vault and paint it on the side of the building. You know, it just doesn't make sense. And so the people that are really serious about this, they want anonymity. They don't want anybody to know who they are, where they are, what they're doing, anything. Because the last thing they want to do is they're sitting there and they've got enough supplies for themselves and their families. What happens if 10 families show up and they all say, gee, you know, we didn't see this coming?
Yep, there's no room for you.
That's right. There's no room. But also the other thing, too, is that people who haven't been preparing, you know, one of the questions I ask folks all the time, you know, Noah was sitting in the ark. And Noah heard these people as the ark is, you know, water's under the keel and the ark's lifting up and people are pounding on the side of the ark, please open up, let us in. These are the same people that were laughing at him saying to his wife, hey, honey, you know, he's not the brightest bulb on the tree and all these other raspy comments. Now all of a sudden they're going, hey, I'm ready to have that conversation. Open the door. He didn't open the door. And it had nothing to do with judgment. Noah was the architect, master, and commander of a vessel charged with a mission to restore terrestrial life following a disaster. That's the simple truth of it. The people outside that were banging on the hull were completely unprepared for what was happening. If he had opened up and let them in, all they would have brought with them would have been sheer anarchy, and the mission would have failed, mission being to restore terrestrial life to the planet. And that's the reason why he didn't open it. I think that I could feel for Noah sitting there hearing that, and the human side of him crying in his soul, let him in, for the love of mercy, for the love of God, let him in. But the master and commander, charged with the responsibility of a vital mission, understood that that would be the end of it. And so I see a great deal of this in the people who are planning and preparing. And what folks have to understand is, this is not about going to a box store and buying 25 tubs and sticking them in the corner of the garage and going, yippee, I'm ready for 2012. Because when the disaster happens, it's not going to have a pre-announcement. Everybody that bought tubs, go ahead and scatter them out in the garage so you can figure out what's in there. No, I mean, the guacamole hits the fan. They're going to be completely unprepared. And because they had, you know, a Kmart blue light special approach to it. You know, go get the survival special of the day, and there you are. To get through what's coming, planning and preparation, and the most important thing is the mental preparation, is programming the mind to adapt to a new situation. For example, in the Sumatra earthquake, all right, and tsunami, who did the dying? Was it the ignorant natives we laugh at because they sing songs about the great turtle shakes the hoochie-coochie tree, and that's when you need to know you got to run?
They were the smart ones.
They were the you got it. Boy, when the hoochie-coochie tree started to shake, or whatever their folklore is, they were all running uphill, screaming, feet don't fail me now. And so were wild animals. It was all of us with college degrees, cars, who know better and can laugh at other people and have domesticated animals that did all the dying. We were the ones that saying intelligent things like, look, Harry, there's stranded fish. Get a basket. It's free lunch. All right? Or the all-time, look at that. Who'd have thunk it? And so when people are responding this way and really not reading the signs, they're not in tune with the earth, that's it. They're tsunami fodder.
Well, what do we recommend short-term, first of all? I'll ask you long-term in a second. But short-term, let's assume it's not as bad as you say, but it takes out the grid for a few weeks, maybe a month or so. What do you recommend?
Well, if it takes out the grid for a few weeks, think about it. Hospitals have 3 days' worth of fuel.
Oh, it's a mess.
It's a mess, but George, what people really don't comprehend is that I am not worried about a shortage of oil, all right? Not in the least bit. As a matter of fact, they're making synthetic oil out of algae.
Well, I'm a believer of the abiotic oil theory, so, you know.
Yeah. So am I. All right, so there's no reason. George, there is no shortage of oil, but the shortage that we have to be worried about is the shortage of oil infrastructure. Go back to Katrina. What happened?
That's right.
Terminals, refineries, pipelines,
right.
They were taken
out. We don't have enough good refineries right now. That's the part of the problem.
That's right. And most of them, I lived in Houston. I actually used to sell computers to those refineries, all right? They're right at sea level. And we take them out, that's it. You can have all the oil you want in the ground. It's useless black goo if you can't pull it, refine it, and move it to market and where it's usable. And so what will happen is the supply chain breaks down. And then that's where it all goes. So even if it's just a matter of a few weeks, whatever is going to cause something like that is also going to be taking out the infrastructure. So people, you know, if you're planning – right now, look at what's happening with food prices. We're having huge amounts of, Texas, for example. I don't even know if they can grow anything in Texas anymore. They're killing off the herds. Farmers are going out of business left and right. We're having problems in other areas. And we're seeing these shortfalls in the main crops. Food prices are going up steadily in the stores. So right now, for people, it's go out and stockpile while you can afford it. And if you really don't know what to do, go for things. You know, if you like, you know, if you like cheese, you like noodles, you like spaghetti, get 6 months' worth of those things. If you don't like tuna fish, don't get 6 months' worth of tuna fish.
It's not a matter of... Yeah, it's a matter of when, isn't it?
That's right. And so it's a matter of stockpiling, which is important. But equally important is that when people are doing it, all right, imagine yourself using that in a catastrophic situation. Instead of being a consummate shopper with, you know, looking for the biggest bang for the buck and check off lists and whatever, no, that's not what you do. I mean, when I was writing Planet X forecasts, what's the one tool you got to take with you? And I figured it would be a 20-ounce construction framing hammer. And I'm in the store, and I'm going, okay, if I'm going to pick a hammer, it's got to have multiple uses. I got to be able to fight with a hammer. I need to be able to pull myself up out of somewhere, pull up nails so I can take debris and hammer it into a new structure.
Mm-hmm.
But with the fighting part, you know, I'm sitting there with the balancing.
You're going to chase somebody with a hammer, Marshall?
No. What you do with a hammer, if you have a good hammer and you have the right kind of hammer, if you hit them with the head of the hammer or with the shank of the hammer, you're going to break or bruise bone. And the whole point of it is that you're going to be able to defend yourself close up. And what people are not...
Why don't you just get a gun?
I've got that, too. Very specifically, I think that if you want to get something for survival, the one that, after I did the research on the market, is the Glock 21-45 caliber. The reason why is that it's very simple to operate. A woman or a child can pick it up. If you drop it and can't shoot it, it's just as simple to shoot as a revolver, aim, pull the trigger.
You know, I have handguns, I have a concealed weapons permit, but if I had a lot of people living with me, I would make sure all of them went through a gun safety course.
Absolutely.
Yep.
Absolutely.
Critical.
Yes. Yes. And the reason why I'm stuck on the .45 caliber, and also, you know, I think it's instead of going out and getting a fancy rifle that's going to be, you know, $2,000 with the scope and the custom barrel, get a whole bunch of old Mosin Nagants or Mausers. The ammunition is cheap. It's 30 caliber. The whole point is that I'm less concerned about having defended myself from people. I'm more concerned about defending myself against animals. Here's the reason why. When the solar storm started hitting and roasting everything, we will know to go to ground. The animals are not. They're going to be above ground. They're going to get burned, half blind.
They're going to be running everywhere, just like the movie Knowing. Remember they came out of the forest?
That's right. That's right. And these animals are just going to be beside themselves. They're going, they're going to come at us. And if we have water and there's no water out there and you've got some water set aside, they'll smell that water. They'll smell your food. All right. People, you know, if you're a hunter, you know, you got to get a good scent back. But city folk aren't going to understand that. And the whole point of the .45 caliber is that caliber bullet was designed specifically for one mission, that it had to kill a horse. And so you can stop a charging animal with a .45. With a 9mm, you can pray and spray, but unless you get a good vital organ shot, tough darts.
And this, of course, let's preface this, it's when the end is near.
That's right. That's right. And so folks are going to have that. And the important thing is the way that you prepare your mind for this is that you think about these things. You actually, if you're going to buy, you're going to go buy food, all right? You can get white flour, and that's going to fill you up, but it's not going to give you nutrition.
No, exactly. And vitamins, you need all that. Marshall, stay with us. We're coming back in just a moment. Final hour to go with you. And we shall open up the phone lines now with Marshall Masters, author of Crossing the Cusp. And also, he's got his video out there on December 21st, 2012. We'll be back.